This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Early holiday savings have arrived at Tanger Outlets. Discover the best gifts from your favorite brands, perfect for everyone on your list. And stack your savings with up to 70% off, plus an extra 15 to 25% off only during Tanger Style. Save at Polo Ralph Lauren, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, Skechers, J.Crew Factory, and more. Hurry in. These early holiday deals last through November 24th. Tanger Outlets. More savings, more cheer.
Just shows you the insidious nature of what they're doing. It's like they go after the people that they think they can get a scalp from that person and that person. And if they thought they hate me, they tried to come after me by going after DonorBox. I got kicked off of PayPal for life.
Wow.
Etsy, lifetime ban.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the grand, stunt me a destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Today, I am in the wonderful city of Nashville, so I had to catch up with this man right here. He is an evolutionary biologist. He's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he is a returning guest to the podcast, and this is my friend Colin Wright.
Hey, so good to be here. Last time we chatted was during COVID, I think, so it's great to finally see in person here.
No doubt, man. Be back to somewhat normal life.
Yeah, it's been normal here for a while.
So. Awesome, man. So, Colin, for people who are not familiar with who you are and what you do, give them a little intro, please.
Yeah, it's an interesting... I'm not sure exactly what I do all the time because it's so many different things, but I guess I'm the guy on the internet who tells people that biology is real, that you can trust your eyes, at least for the most part, with respect to the biology of male and female, that it's a real. These are real categories. I started off, I guess, writing popular articles about this because I saw a lot of colleagues of mine when I was... a postdoc at Penn State making weird claims about there being five sexes, or there's sex as a spectrum, you know, infinite number of them, or maybe there's zero sexes, it's just a social construct and it's just totally arbitrary. Doing some pushback against that, writing popular articles, and then I've really just in the last few years moved from, you know, op-eds are good and everything, it's good to get the word out and talk about, you know, the issues that we see in academia and in the culture related to these issues, but, you know, changing an actual word or a sentence in the law is something that I think was worth 1,000 op-eds. So I've been helping working with the Heritage Foundation a little bit. I've helped them develop what's called the Defining Sex Act, which is this model legislation that is meant to be given to all the states, and even other countries can use it if they want to, that just really defines what male and female is, because you know, this is stuff we all knew what these things were not that long ago. And so they didn't have to say in the law, like, you know, here's male is these things, and it had to, you know, it wasn't like a biology textbook. And then a lot of activists sort of preyed on the fact that it was just sort of went without saying for so long that what males and females were, what men and women were. So this model legislation is meant to just give states the most robust, scientifically, you know, ironclad definition they can that will be impenetrable from activists trying to undermine it. So a lot of states have been implementing this, and then once they do, the ACLU sues them immediately, and then they usually call me to try to defend the Defining Sex Act against the ACLU and all these other places. So I've gone in courts and I've had cross-examined by lawyers, and it's been wild.
How have we gotten to a stage in the modern Western world where we are having needing to even have discussions on something that is so self-evident and has been since before people even knew what science itself was.
It's really just a takeover of a, I mean, it is such a minority viewpoint, but it's sort of wedged itself into these institutions that are very prestigious, and so they have just this inordinate amount of power. So it really comes from these hyper-academic, I mean, I guess they're academic, but that usually sounds like a compliment, but in this case, it's like, no, they're just, they're so insane that only an academic could believe in them, like, because they have to, they're smart and they can have, you know, they can basically argue themselves into these crazy knots. So it's come from this area called queer theory. It has nothing to do with people who identify as queer. It's really this idea that we're going to go and queer nature by, you know, blurring boundaries between anything and interrogate every single category that's out there and find out, because we think that, or at least they think that, categories are somehow a result of really powerful people trying to maintain these categories in order to oppress others. And so, you know, it's always good to interrogate categories. I mean, scientists, this is what scientists do. This is not like, this is not something new. It's not like we need queer theory in science. It's like scientists already interrogate the categories they're studying, the definitions they're using, and finding out if something is actually real. But the thing is that scientists have something what's called like an alternative hypothesis that, you know, if it's not this thing, then it must be this other thing. Whereas the queer theorists, it's all destructive. It's just, we're just going to poke holes in everything and use fallacious logic just to make it so we can't really say anything. It just leaves you kind of floundering, not knowing what we're doing. So this has been applied to the biology of sex, where they'll say, you know, we have males and females, and okay, sure, but what about these individuals? They have these, you know, one in a million condition where they have ambiguous biology to some respect. And then, you know, you can say, well, these are really interesting medical cases, but they try to use them to then blur the entire image and say, well, if we can't really know what this person is here because they have this weird genetic developmental problem, then, you know, we're all kind of, you know, weird and unable to place into a certain box, and so we just need to throw up our hands and let people just self-identify into their own sex category.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bitbox. As I'm sure you've noticed by now, inflation is a major issue. The more money that central banks print, the less your dollars, pounds, and euros are worth. When it comes to government-issued fiat currency, inflation is inevitable. That's why for many years I've been saving in Bitcoin. It's scarcer than gold, and it cannot be inflated by any central bank. But if you're going to buy and hold Bitcoin, it's vital that you store it securely, because leaving your coins on exchanges is risky and leaves them vulnerable to potential hacks. That's where today's sponsor, Bitbox, comes in. Bitbox is a Swiss-made hardware wallet that allows you to store your Bitcoin easily and safely. It only takes a few minutes to set up a wallet and take full custody of your coins the same way I do. Secure your Bitcoin today with a Bitbox. Go to bitbox.swiss/Zuby to get 5% off a hardware wallet today. That's bitbox.swiss/Zuby for 5% off. Yeah, it's weird because I was going to say, like, because it goes beyond that. I mean, all of that is almost kind of a distraction, because a lot of the people pushing this idea ultimately believe that you can just say, quote unquote, identify as whatever you are, and you're that thing. So it's almost like the biological aspect of it, as interesting as it may be, it's kind of a bit of a red herring in some ways, because outside of that, they still think that, okay, you could be, you know, you don't have some sort of intersex condition or anything like that. But if tomorrow you were to come out and say that you're a woman or that you're non-binary, or you could just invent your own one, that everyone is supposed to just fall in line and accept, even if they don't even know what it means, and you're some type of horrible person if you even question that.
Yeah, I've construed what they try to do as like this intersex trap that they get you. So they want to say that sex is this blurry category, and it's totally socially constructed. And they'll use intersex people in order to, you know, try to blur the whole thing. Then you look at someone like Leah Thomas, say, who's been, you know, the swimmer, the male swimmer, who is now the Division One NCAA Division One women's, you know, champion, at least a couple of years ago. And so someone like me and you will say, well, I mean, you were the deadlift women's champion. they'll say that, you know, we'll say this is absurd. You can't have someone who's biologically male competing in a female sport. And then they'll say, oh, well, what about these rare intersex conditions? And then you'll say, then, you know, what we should be responding is like, well, yeah, but Leah Thomas does not have any of these conditions. So they want to use these little category, these edge cases to apply to people who aren't edge cases in order just to say that, you know, sex is totally arbitrary. So we need to separate out, like, people who are just identifying as something that they're unambiguously not versus people who might have some sort of developmental condition, like Imane Khalif, the boxer, sure. You know, who, the Algerian boxer who won gold in the Olympics this year. This was an instance of someone who had a difference of sexual development where early on, especially in a country like Algeria, in a lot of developing countries, this condition that Imane has makes it so they appear, at least as far as their genitals go, they appear to be female, and so they're not doing a lot of prenatal screening on these people, and so often they'll put female on the birth certificate. But this specific condition, you know, when puberty comes along, they actually have internal testes, and you go through a full male puberty once, you know, surprise, once you're 12 years old. But this has never got flagged, and so this is now how you have someone who's biologically male competing in the female category. You know, it's different than a Leah Thomas case, but it's still something that we need to track. We need to be able to say that these are biological males and they shouldn't be, you know, allowed to compete in a category that's specifically designed so that females have a chance at competing in a meaningful way and winning.
It seems like 10 years ago, pretty much nobody was having these conversations. And something happened around 2014 or 2015, which has just thrust all of this into the spotlight, not just here in the USA, but in the UK, in Canada, in Australia, New Zealand, parts of Western Europe. It really seems to be a Western and especially Anglosphere phenomenon, and it really seems to be over the past decade. I'm aware that prior to that, there were, you know, there have always been cross-dressers, or there have been people who, I'd heard the term transsexual, right? Someone who's undergone certain surgeries and those type of things. But this whole issue of transgenderism and the obsession with gender and it just becoming this massive topic, it constantly puzzles me because I still exist in reality and in the real world, and I travel all the time. I'm in different cities, I'm in different countries, and as I'm going about my day, I can see males and I can see females. I see boys and girls. I see men and women. Once every few weeks, I might see someone. It's like, not totally sure. They're a little bit ambiguous. But I'm just wondering how such a tiny, microscopic number of people, both in terms of those who identify as such, but also those who are pushing this ideology, have been able to just gain so much ground and so much focus and so much conversation over the past decade. It's just like sucking so much time and energy. It's just very disproportionate, which is the thing that's there's a lot of things that are baffling to me, but that's particularly odd.
I think the reason you're seeing an explosion in it is really because the definition of what it means to be transgender, you mentioned, you know, we used to call these people transsexuals, but now we say transgender. Well, that's actually a pivot in definition that expands the definition to include a really large proportion of the population. So if you were to look at the CDC, at the American Psychological Association, WPATH, the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, you can see this shift in how their policy used to say transsexual to transgender. And they all define transgenderism now in this insanely broad way. They say that transgender is an umbrella term for anyone whose identity, expression, or behavior differs from what is typically associated with their, and they would say, sex assigned at birth, well, we would just say their sex. And so they're really just transing just common sex nonconformity, like a feminine male or a masculine woman. So a tomboy under this definition of someone who has a form of expression or behavior that's not typically associated with their sex. I mean, the behavior of male and females, they're broad. You know, there's average differences, but we have the distributions overlap, where you can have really, really effeminate men, you can have really masculine women, and this movement is now using them to say that, oh, your identity is now incongruent with your sex assigned at birth, because they define gender in terms of of stereotypes. And so if you're not stereotypical for your sex, you're now in this trans umbrella, and this applies to a lot of people. And this applies in the reason we're seeing this spike in trans identities from females, specifically adolescent females, is because, you know, when they're starting to grow up and they're starting to develop, they're getting attention maybe they don't want anymore. They don't like, you know, the pressure from society and that type of thing. And, you know, basically this ideology has given them an out of womanhood. If they don't want to get into it, they can just say, well, oh, look, I cut my hair now and I'm wearing jeans, and that means I'm no longer a woman. So it's sort of an escape hatch for them. And this is, I think, just this expanding definition needs to be looked at more, because we're constantly going through, like, well, is it greater societal acceptance or is it social contagion? It's just like, well, it's kind of all of these things. But the definition, I think, is key, because, I mean, there's so many people who are in a room. If you don't see women who are just wearing gowns, it's like they're wearing jeans. They're, you know, these are, you know, they're not perfectly stereotypically female, and, you know, they're trans now. So we're all basically trans if under this really broad definition. Yeah.
Do you think that this is, are we just too comfortable and too bored?
Yes.
Do you think this is a sort of, what would you put it, something that is a result of material success and comfort?
I think absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I mean, you don't see this in a lot of the developing world, because, no. You know, well, I think sex differences are more important. Well, I guess they come to the surface more in a lot of these countries, because if a lot of your work has to be more physical labor and stuff, and you know, maybe access to birth control is lower, and so you have more, you know, families being made, more kids. I mean, the sex differences are incredibly stark in a lot of more developing countries, where you can't just ignore this thing. But if you're in a, you know, a really bougie society that, you know, you're just, oh, you know, maybe we won't have kids, maybe we'll, you know, in our late 30s or something, and where sex differences aren't that, you know, everyone's working from home from their computers, you know, their sex differences don't come into it as much, and we're not as physical beings in these societies, and so you can argue yourselves into crazy knots because you don't have a tether to reality anymore. You're not really seeing the sex differences, I guess, in your everyday life, so it can lead people to think that these things don't matter, or they're negligible, or they're much smaller than they really are.
Today's podcast is sponsored by my book, Strong Advice, Zuby's Guide to Fitness for Everybody. When it comes to health, exercise, and nutrition, there are a huge number of resources available. Some are great, but others, not so much. The problem with a lot of fitness advice is it's unnecessarily complicated. This can leave you feeling even more confused, with underwhelming and unsustainable results. Most diets fail, and even when they do work, most people simply regain the weight. Strong Advice is different because the sole goal of the book is to help you and not to confuse you. It's simple enough for beginners, but detailed enough for experienced lifters. No nonsense, just valuable information. Strong Advice has already helped thousands of people to achieve and maintain their fitness goals, and whether your goal is to lose fat, build muscle, or just get in better shape, it can help you too. Visit ZubyFitness.com to get $10 off the ebook or audiobook version of Strong Advice. That's ZubyFitness.com, and as a loyal podcast listener, you'll automatically get $10 off. Enjoy the rest of the podcast.
I'm still trying to work out the exact sort of catalyst that happened a decade ago, because, I mean, we have been materially comfortable for a while. We've even had social media definitely plays some type of role, but we had social media prior to that, and smartphones, and it just seems like post Caitlyn Jenner, I think Caitlyn Jenner was a massive catalyst in terms of the mainstreaming of this, because the thing that I found weirdest with that was that no one asked any questions. So you have an individual known as Bruce Jenner, who has been a man for 60 years, fathered children, won multiple athletes in men's competitions in the Olympics, is well known on TV, comes out and says he's a woman, and no one says, what do you mean? What exactly does that mean? That wasn't just the basic question of, like, okay, what does that even mean? Because if you say that sentence to most people around the world, they just give you a blank look. So, as you know, over 5 years ago, I had that very famous tweet where I said I identified as a woman and I broke the British women's deadlift record. And all of my friends in the UK, US, Canada, and so on, all the people in those countries understood it. Some of my family back in Nigeria, they saw, oh, their cousin or nephew is going viral. He's done something on the internet. And if I tried to explain it to them, they're just like, what do you mean?
Yeah, like, it's just well, a what? Goofy, yeah, because, a weird goofy thing.
Like, yeah, because you need the full context for it to even be funny, right? If in the year 1998, someone posted that or someone said that, you didn't even have the cultural context for the humor to make sense. Because firstly, you'd be like, well, no one is saying that men, who's saying that men don't have strength advantages over women like that? Yeah. It would be a complete straw man. And if you say you're a man and you've got a beard and you're buff and you're identifying as a woman, like what does that even mean? It just falls flat. So I've had these conversations with people in like different countries and they're just like, what do you even mean? It's like in that Matt Walsh documentary. And they don't even, it's just like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like you're a man, clearly. What are you talking
about? Yeah. I think that there's been multiple reasons why maybe in the last 10 years, I think a lot of the spikes tend to pick up around 2014, 15. I've spoken to Wilfred Riley about this, and I'm sure you know Wilfred. And he has a good idea, and I think he hit it on the head. I mean, at least I think it's a major thing that explains this. As you look at, you know, the LGBT community, as they call it, plus, and what was the main issue back in, you know, the early 2010s before 2015?
Same-sex marriage.
Everything was same-sex marriage. Yep. And whether you agree with it or not, that was where they were going with all the money that came in there, these organizations. You know, the Human Rights Commission, HRC, ACLU, there were just so many, Trevor Project, just so many of these organizations just got huge so fast and with so much donation money on this one issue. And then they won. They got gay marriage legalized federally. And then what happens with a lot of these NGOs, these nonprofits who've been set up, getting funding off this one big issue that they've just won, you know, you just turn the lights off, shut the doors, fire everybody. Well, they can't do that. You have all these donors who we want to give money apart. They're getting tax breaks for this stuff too. So there's a major pivot. And so you can see like the funding and the advertising for the ACLU and HRC and everything move from, you know, pamphlets that were talking about, you know, gay rights, gay marriage, all this stuff, same-sex couples. And it just completely flipped to trans rights, gender identity, all this stuff. And so you have this built-in system of NGOs who are getting hundreds of millions of dollars, and all of a sudden they're just shunting all this money that they have into this really niche issue that just took everyone by storm. Because there aren't any organizations that were there that were prepared for this. And so in the last 6 years, it's just been a mad scramble to try to get organizations not just funded but created in the first place and organized and having people find out what are they even saying, because this was an ideology that had just been in these dusty departments in academia for a while. Now they're thrust onto the main stage. People don't know what they're doing. You get gaslight all the time when you said, like, you know, people are actually saying that sex isn't real. Like, no one's saying sex is real. You still get that sometimes, but people tend to get it now. So now we have good organizations, GenSpect, Segem. They're out there that are actually giving them a run for their money, and they're well organized, and so we're finally able to do some pushback. But the funding is still like, I mean, over 100 to 1.
Where's the funding coming from?
You know, whoever was the people that were initially funding them for gay marriage stuff. I mean, I know the Pritzker family is big, and at least in the trans stuff. You know, just a lot of political. I mean, there's a lot of individual donations too, because they're donating based on the sort of legacy of issues that they thought were good, that they won. Like, you know, like people who donated to gay marriage, they have a very positive view of places like the ACLU and HRC. Mm-hmm. And so they just feel comfortable writing them more checks down the road.
It's more like they're donating to the organization than the cause, maybe?
Yeah, well, and they think the cause must be righteous because this organization, in their view, was on the right side of history for all these issues. Mm. And they're trying to do the same playbook, too, by criticizing people like me who are coming from the left who are supportive of gay marriage and that type of stuff. They're trying to say that, no, I'm actually this far-right crazy person.
They call me
Christian nationalist. I'm not even a Christian yet.
Welcome.
So I get thrust over with this group just because I'm saying basic biological facts.
Yeah.
And now it's they have to paint me the same way that they would paint, you know, the opposition to gay marriage, even though these are completely different things. And there's plenty of people who, I mean, you see the organization like Gays Against Groomers, who are like, this is a gay organization where they're saying, you know, we want to be separate from this because being gay isn't an ideology. We're just, you know, we're just attracted to people of the same sex, whereas the whole gender stuff, it requires believing things that are pseudoscientific or plainly just aren't true. So, yeah, these are completely different issues.
Yeah, well, I think an issue that exists, I generally avoid using the terms the left and the right just because I think it plays into the division and it's a bit too broad. It's, you know, it could kind of split society down just two directions.
Yeah.
Especially when you know, people who are moderate left or moderate right tend to actually be closer in belief than people who are further on the fringes. You have that type of horseshoe theory. But I think that one thing that definitely is a function of the left and liberalism, of course, is that boundaries are much more blurry and fuzzy and disliked in general. So conservatives are all about boundaries in everything, like politically, socially, culturally. Like the more conservative you are, the more of a fan of boundaries you are and the more rigid they are. And I think that any sane person would agree, yeah, we need some boundaries, but we also need to be able to question them, remove them if they're not good ones. Certain times things will be blurry. We need to be able to accommodate exceptions in certain cases and so on. I think that's kind of a fairly obvious thing to anyone who is reasonable. You don't even need to be politically charged to know that. You just need to be a functioning adult. And I think that with this one, they've just sort of massively jumped the shark. And it's the one of the strangest things about this ideology, because I've had so many of these conversations over the years now, and I don't know if I've ever come across someone who I know they must exist, but when really sort of like pushed and questioned, I don't know if I've ever come across an actual true believer, like someone who really genuinely believes that male and female don't exist, or that there's just infinite genders, or that there's no physicality differences between men and women, or even interest differences, because the way they live their own lives and the way they speak generally belies these facts, right? So if they saw us having a conversation, they'd be like, oh, look at those two men talking, right? They would assume our genders. They wouldn't be like, oh, wait, we can't say that those are men. We need to find out their pronouns and so on. So they say all of this stuff, but then in the real world, they don't abide by it. They'd be like, oh, yeah, that woman over there. Oh, that man. Oh, go talk to that man. They're not like, oh, yeah, talk to that individual who is presenting as such, right? They assume gender all the time. They have certain expectations of men and certain expectations of women. When it comes to certain issues, right, they all, vote for Kamala Harris because she's a woman. It's like, wait, oh, you know what a woman is now. I thought that just a couple of years ago it was you had to be a biologist to say what a woman is. And so they sort of flip-flop back and forth just depending on whatever is convenient at the time. There's not any, it would still be absurd, but at least if they were like consistent with it and they just were like, okay, we live in a totally genderless society and they assume nothing, I'd at least be like, okay, that person's consistent, but I've never come across an individual like that.
I have a friend, Emma Hilton, Dr. Emma Hilton. She's in the UK, University of Manchester, and she does a lot of the stuff that I do as well, but sort of on the UK side of things. She's a great biologist, and what she does, a lot of these activists who are maybe academics and scientists who are going out there saying the things like sex isn't real or whatever, she'll look at their publication history and like what their system that they're studying is. And, you know, maybe they're studying like fruit fly genetics or something like that. And she'll pull up one of their most recent papers and it's just like, male fruit fly is this, female fruit. And it's just like, where are the non-binary fruit flies? Like in their research, they clearly know that sex is a real thing. And they'll have no problem saying it very clearly, and you know, it's this binary thing in their research. But then somehow, when it comes to humans, it's just like, you know, we don't know what we're talking about. You know, we can't ever really know what sex somebody is. Yet somehow they're able to just to like glance at a fruit fly and know immediately. And also, I mean, the ideology of these people, it's doing a lot of these court cases has really just opened my eyes to, because it makes, if you have an expert report coming in from someone on the other side, they have to just spell it out. I mean, this is for a judge. This is for something. You need to make your argument as clear and empirical as possible. And so I've been looking at what they've been saying and how they're trying to portray this whole thing, what WPATH is, how they're defining these terms. They have like these glossaries of terms that are really eye-opening if you want to look at them. And they have this like this two-tiered belief system. It's, we have something called the gender binary, which is distinct from the sex binary. And the gender binary is just these the social norms and expectations that you society sort of pressures individuals into based on their perceived sex. So you have that. You know, just think of like paragons of pure masculinity and femininity. And then they want to say that there's also, well, the sex binary. Now, I would say that has to do with like the gametes you produce, but they would say that this is, you know, there's actually no real binary of sex. You just have, based on, you know, your primary and sexual, secondary sexual characteristics, you can sort of be statistically more male and more female. And they would say that your gender identity has to do with where you would sort of place yourself mentally on this spectrum of masculinity and femininity. And then your sex is a statistical, you know, basis of where you might place yourself on a scale of kind of having mostly masculine looking anatomy and genetics and hormones versus the other. And you know, it's completely crazy way to look at things. And it's also used as the justification for sort of this pediatric gender affirming care, because they're trying to say, oh, there's this little boy, you know, oh, he was assigned male at birth, but oh, look, he's playing with dolls. That means his gender identity is, you know, not all on the male side, it's more on the female side. And then so they would then classify this kid as having a mismatch between their gender identity and their sex assigned at birth. And then that's what how WPATH defines what being trans is. So now this kid is trans and there's a mismatch, even though this is just a sex nonconforming boy, like, leave him alone. And you know, this puts people down this pathway of, well, one, there's something wrong with you. You have a mismatch that's just internal to you. Mm-hmm. But then because sex is this constellation, this statistical thing of various body parts, well, we can change those body parts with hormones and surgeries, and we can actually move you along the sex spectrum so that your physical sex matches where your gender identity is.
That's the craziest.
That is what they're arguing in the courts. This is what WPATH is doing. This is what the ACLU does when they're trying to cross-examine me in here. And so, I mean, most people don't realize like the weird nuance of that, but the pseudoscience of sex is being used. It's the premise of these surgeries, really. So my job, I see it when I come into these courtrooms, is saying this premise is completely flawed. Like, we can talk about, you know, we had the CAST review come out in the UK that was looking at, like, do these procedures actually work, or are they getting better mental health from these things? And I'm saying, why are we measuring the outcomes of these procedures if the premise of the procedures themselves is total pseudoscience and not rooted in reality? You know, I liken it to, you know, exorcisms or something, where it's just like you have someone who's spasming, maybe they have epilepsy. You know, we're saying, like, let's give these people exorcisms, and then we're measuring the outcomes from these exorcisms. But it's like, why are we measuring the outcomes from exorcism of these people when, you know, we need to be asking the fundamental question is, like, are they actually possessed by demons? You know, if they're not, then we shouldn't be performing exorcisms on these people. And that's kind of how
the thing is, though, even then, you know, and obviously I know we have different religious perspectives. If you perform an exorcism on someone who is not possessed by a demon, I know you don't believe in demons, but theoretically, and they didn't have a demon, nothing happens.
Yeah, yeah.
If you,
but if right. they believe they have a demon, sure. maybe, and they believe you cast it out, maybe they'll actually improve.
Yeah, I mean, this would be more like, I mean, if you did an exorcism by, you know, taking a knife or surgical instruments and like chopping up someone's body and removing parts of it and changing their hormonal profile, I mean, these are physical things with very real consequences.
Yeah.
Right. So if you do that, I mean, the fact that it makes me feel gross to even like think, let alone talk about the fact that like this is something that people are even like pushing on children.
Just contemplating
because that used to be such a hard line in society, regardless of people's political beliefs and orientations. It was just like, look, there's some really important boundaries that exist in society. Male and female is one of them, but one of them is adults and children. Okay, so if someone wanted to take their five-year-old to get a tattoo sleeve, or to, you know, if you wanted to let a 10-year-old drive a car on the highway or drink alcohol. I mean, just in this country, you have to be 21, not even just an adult, you have to be 21 to drink alcohol. Everyone understands, like, you know, that's an important boundary when it comes to sexual intercourse or sexual activity, right? Adults, children, that's a line. And what's so gnarly about this isn't just the physical and social repercussions of what they're doing and what they're pushing here, but also, again, just this blurring and attempted removal of that boundary and distinction between, okay, you're an adult, you know, I'm in a free country, okay, we might think something is weird, not understand everything, whatever, but if you're an adult of sound mind and you want to live your life in a certain way, okay. I mean, that hasn't been, as far my entire life, that people generally haven't really debated that. Mm-hmm. That's like, okay, not everyone's going to approve of it, and not everyone has to.
Bruce Jenner wants to do and become Caitlyn.
Sure, like, you want to wear it? Like, cross-dressing's not new. I think it's weird, right? I don't think a man should wear a dress. But if they want to do it, I'm not here trying to create laws saying that they can't. But when you're pushing this on children, you're just, it's a very, very dark path. You're just opening Pandora's box because you're essentially saying, oh yeah, a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, whatever, is sound enough of mind and developed enough and emotionally wise enough to make a permanent life-altering decision. Something as permanent as the fact that you may now be rendering yourself infertile for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Right? If you go to a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old or even a 14-year-old, maybe even an 18 or 20-year-old, you say, you know, some of them might be like, oh, I don't want to have kids. So that might change by the time you're 30, 35, 40, 45, right? And these permanent.
I used to be very, you know, I didn't call myself a dink, you know, the dual income, no kids. But I was, that was my view before. I didn't want kids my entire life until just a couple of years ago. And I mean, when I was in graduate school, I even, you know, went to an appointment, just a consultation for a vasectomy. I didn't do it. I didn't go through with the procedure. Very happy that I didn't do that because, you know, now I want a kid more than anything. I want to have a family. And, you know, if I was just in my early 30s, I would have been, you know, I was almost certain that I would never want to have children. And then you're taking these kids before they've even gone through puberty. They haven't had time to think about, do they want to be a parent one day?
They're still
dependent on their own parents. They haven't matured and had a chance at life experiences. I mean, it took me like a life experience to realize the importance of creating your own family and why I want to do this now, and just the way they hand wave away these concerns, like, oh, don't worry, we can, you know, we'll just preserve some of this tissue, but you know, if it's before puberty, it's not. They have to then like get this tissue that's not currently producing any sort of gametes or whatever, and then they have to sort of reanimate this and add hormones to it, and then the chances that you can...
When you're talking about reanimating tissue, what are you specifically talking about?
So if you want to try to do fertility preservation before you've gone through puberty, before you're even producing sperm or woman, you're producing eggs, it's easier for women because they're born with all the eggs they have, but it's not the case with males. We start producing sperm during puberty. So if you take a pre-pubertal male and you want to do some sort of fertility preservation, you actually have to take testicular tissue from them that is not currently functional, and then, you know, hopefully, and they're still frozen in 20 years, and then after that, you bring it back, and you have to basically have this tissue go through its own puberty so it can be mature enough to start producing sperm, and then you have to get those out, and then you have to try to implant them. It's wildly expensive. It has an incredibly high failure rate. And we're telling kids that this is just a viable option. Like, oh, we can do that for you. And they have no idea what they're signing up for. I mean, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I have a problem with telling an 18-year-old that, you know, here, sign up for these student loans because, you know, they don't know what they're doing. It's that they're just pressured into doing, okay, what am I doing? And then they're $100,000 in debt in 4 years. But I can't imagine doing that same type of thing with your potential
something
fertility,
more serious.
Something more serious. I mean, so many people children is like the most meaningful thing in their entire lives. Like, to take that away from kids, or to potentially take it away, or doing some kind, even a social trans, a lot of people try to construe like, well, we'll just use their different name and pronouns, but we're not going to do any hormones or anything yet. But this is, I mean, just the social transition alone for a kid, it's just like a psychosocial intervention. And we have data that shows that kids who are socially transitioned are almost 100%, it's like 97, 98% likely to proceed on to taking hormones and surgeries, because mm-hmm. you're kind of locking in their dysphoria in their mind. They might be confused, and then you start going along with them, let's change your name. Like, this, it's like a sunk cost fallacy as you're going along here. These kids get more and more invested. And it would be, frankly, embarrassing, maybe 2 years later, and they're in high school, and they're like, actually, I'm not really the opposite sex. And, you know, they pay a big social cost. They had this big, you know, glitter family as soon as they came out as trans years ago. And, yeah, it's they pay a huge social cost getting out of this. So it's not just about hormones and surgery. It's about the social transition as well. It's about sterility. It's just
the thing is, it's also there's lots of different types of dysmorphias that exist, and in every other case, when there is a discrepancy between someone's body and their physicality and who they are and their mind and their self-perception, whether this is anorexia or this is body integrity dysmorphia, or this is even bigorexia, which is, you know, these guys who they're super jacked and they feel like they're tiny. Everyone recognizes that you treat the mind. You treat the mind so that it aligns with the body. And in this case, it's just inverted. It's just like, okay, no, your body is wrong. Yeah. You were born into the wrong body. So we're now going to use the power of science and technology. I mean, when you were just describing, I hadn't actually heard that thing of the attempt to preserve fertilization. I mean, this is just a massive, grotesque misuse of science and technology. Science is, I always say that, I mean, I don't know your view on this, but I believe that science is amoral, as in it can be used for incredible good and incredible bad. It can be used to murder, maim, destroy, genocide. It can be used to heal and to save lives. Like, I like science. Science is a cool subject. It was my favorite. Yeah. Some of my favorite subjects in school were the sciences. But something like this is just, it's so obviously a destructive, anti-human use of technologies. And maybe that's another part of what we were talking about earlier, because we were saying, why is this happening in the West and in these developed countries? And maybe part of it is also just like, scientifically, it's even possible. So in most parts of the world and throughout 99.9% of human history, even if someone could have perceived some of these ideas, it's like, well, you don't have the technology to even do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't do these things. You don't have the hormone technology. You don't have the surgical technology or whatever. So you can't do these things anyway. Like, you could, there's always been people being, you know, castration has existed throughout history. Okay. They can remove that. But I think that that's a function of it. And then of course there's another dark layer to it, which is that this is massively lucrative.
Oh, it's incredibly lucrative. I agree with your assessment that science is amoral. Yeah, and this is what I try to separate out in my work is, you know, science can't tell you whether males and females should have different sports categories. That has to do with the values of a society. Do you value women being able to compete in a meaningful way and have a career as an athlete, or don't you? My value is that I think that's a good thing. We should have male and female sports. But some people don't want to have these different categories. And it's like, okay, well, you can make an argument about why you don't value it. That's not a scientific case. That's just your values. You have science and you have values. So my role is to say, like, well, here's what the biology is. And given what we know about biology, then we can then see if we can use the science as a tool to bring our values into fruition. But what you're seeing a lot of these activists doing is they don't want males and females to have their own sports. And so instead of just owning that and saying, I just don't think women should have their sports. They're trying to then change the science to like back up their view by saying, well, we can't have male and female sports because they don't even, males and females don't even exist. Mm-hmm. And so my job, I see it as just being like, well, no, your premise is completely off of this. Males and females do exist. And if you want to argue against male or female sports, then go for it. But they don't want to do that because they want the males to compete against the females, honestly. The first point you made was about for any other thing in society when you have anorexia or bigorexia or abdominophilia, if you want limbs removed mm-hmm. or whatever. Yeah, we treat the mind. We say, nope, let's try to make this person more comfortable in their body. Let's say, like, you're not fat, you weigh 100 pounds and you're 6'7" or 5'7" for a girl, like you're withering away. It's inverted, but it's inverted in also a really pernicious way because, again, in their ideology, like your gender identity is akin to your soul. It's who you are. And any attempt at changing that, any attempt to get you to be comfortable in your body, if you're a sex nonconforming boy and you recognize that you're feminine, and I would say just, you can be feminine, whatever, but they would say your gender identity is often you have a mismatch. It's a really, they think that attempting to change your gender identity to make you comfortable with your body, even though you can identify everyone, whatever, just be comfortable with your body, they're saying that this is not only what we shouldn't do, they say any attempt to do it to make you comfortable in your body is itself conversion therapy. And this is why you see all these conversion therapy bans that, were put in place in terms of people's sexuality, which just shows that it is much more of an innate trait for people. And so they're just adding things like gender identity to these conversion therapy bans, because if you're on the left and you had followed gay rights for a long time, you're like, conversion therapy, bad. But when this is applied to, people's gender identities, well, it means that if a kid says that they're trans and they want to have surgeries, you can't interrogate them. You can't say, well, were you abused as a child? What happened? Why do you think this? Why? What is this? Because any sort of exploration therapy, it's called watchful waiting. Mm. They construe that as harmful, potentially something that leads to their suicide, conversion therapy, because you're trying to change their gender identity to match their sex.
What's crazy is the manipulation of language, because everything they say is an inversion of the truth,
yeah.
Right? So when they say gender affirming care, it's gender denying care. When they say what was that term that you just used? That conversion therapy.
Yeah.
A gender transition is a conversion therapy.
Yeah, but it's like more of a sex conversion.
A sex change is a conversion therapy. Yeah. Putting a man on female hormones or vice versa is a conversion therapy. So they take the language and they twist it upside down. I mean, this is where, as a Christian, this is where it gets somewhat biblical to me, because in the Bible it says, evil will be called good and good will be called evil. So they've just like flipped it on its head.
Yeah.
So they're using the language in a way that, to a normal person's brain, as you said, they'll think, oh, conversion therapy, we probably shouldn't be like trying to, I think historically, right, they used to, try to electrically shock, gay men and that type of stuff. And it's like, that's where their brain goes. Or if they hear gender affirming care, that the word care, it makes people's brains go, that sympathetic part lights up and you go, oh, it's called care. So I guess it's a good thing. So they sort of prey on people's naivete, but also their compassion, because most people, I would say most people are decent, or at least trying to be, and most people have a reasonable level of compassion and empathy, and they don't want people to be harmed. When they use terms like harm, oh, you're harming this person. So you're saying you're harming the person by leaving them alone. You're not harming them by doing, we haven't even gotten into some of the physical and health consequences and ramifications of these hormones and these surgeries. I mean, I've heard testimonies from people who have gone through these things, some of these detransitioners, and the quite gory details of what it actually involves and what the lifelong repercussions are. And to say that that is care, but to have left them alone as the way they were born into the world.
Completely healthy body.
That is harming them. That's what there's just so many layers of how it's insidious.
Yeah. I mean, the whole gay conversion therapy thing, I mean, I said this in an article, 2020 Wall Street Journal, that really the gender-affirming care is, I think it's the new, modern, and more grotesque gay conversion therapy there is, because if you think about people who are more sex nonconforming, not all of them, but a healthy portion of them tend to be same-sex attracted. Mm-hmm. And going back to WPATH's definition of what it means to be trans, having expression or behaviors that are not typical for your sex, well, being same-sex attracted is not typical, and they usually have other mannerisms that are more typical of the opposite sex, too. And so if we get these individuals and we say, like, oh, you're actually born in the wrong body, let's transition you, well, you take someone who probably would have grown up to be just a normal, happy gay man, and you turn them into a straight woman. Mm-hmm. Or
trans woman.
So you well, in their mind, they would cease to be gay, because now they've also redefined what it means to be gay and straight. Instead of being attracted to the same or opposite sex, it's gender now. Yeah. So, I mean, you could see a beautiful woman walking by and you could be like, they're hot, but if they secretly identify as man, you don't know, like, you don't know Zuby, but you're actually bisexual now.
Wouldn't bi imply that there's only two? So shouldn't it be pansexual? Shouldn't bisexuality be somewhat bigoted?
Well, so they've redone the definitions on that too. They'd say that bisexuality now means you're just attracted to those two stereotypes, so you would exclude non-binary people from your sexual pool.
I'm learning.
There is a new term for, like, they would probably say pansexual. There's even another one that I can't remember. It was just a way of saying not heterosexual. I can't remember what it was, but it was like something like non-bisexual. It was like making it somehow.
They really make this stuff complex.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's a flag for it too. So, yeah.
Man, I want to. Do you know what? Gosh, these conversations are crazy, because I sometimes wonder, like, how many trillions of collective hours, at least minutes, and how much. The amount of highly intelligent people, like, I think this, like, even us discussing this topic for however long we've been doing, we're both smart guys. There's a lot of very intelligent people who, rightfully so, are battling these issues, because you can't just be, you can't be apathetic and just let it slide, or it's all going to get worse. And as we've seen, you know, they're pushing this stuff on children and so on. It has real consequences. But the thing I wonder sometimes is, like, man, over the past decade, how much it's such a distracting topic, right? It's like we shouldn't even be needing to have huge debates about whether or not males should be competing against females in sports, or they should be going into female prisons, or this or this. The answers have been known for centuries. Just cool, put a pin in it. We've got that one sorted. Let's go on and use our intelligence, our intellect, our curiosity, our science to do things that are actually going to improve our society and further our culture and make our nations better. And there's just all of these people who are just, again, understandably so, wrapped up in this. But I'll be honest with you, like, every minute I spend talking about it, there's a little part of me which is like, dude, like, why are you spending your time and your energy and your mental juice talking about something that's so asinine, just right on the surface? You don't need to be, I mean, like you said, you need to be an academic to believe it, not to the average layperson all around the world. Yeah. If you were to just ask them about this, they're just like, what are you even talking about?
I used to be a real researcher. I used to be like an actual scientist and do experiments. But it was seeing my colleagues making those, you know, five sexes, no sexes, social construct stuff.
What was the timing of that?
That was in 2018 is when I first went public on this. But they were probably posting stuff like that since 2016, maybe 2015. You know, I just realized that, like, well, because I studied social behavior and insects and spiders and things like that, and it was really cool. I really enjoyed doing it. And I just found myself giving lectures to students and lecturing about my research about, you know, just a really niche academic topic that I think was fascinating. And I'm just looking out at the students, and I was like, okay, why am I giving a lecture on this, like, this frontier of science and this really niche topic of, like, who studies social spiders anyway? But how can I give this and push knowledge forward here when, like, looking back at what other scientists have discovered about the biology of sex, and half the students in my class might not even believe that males and females are real. And I couldn't make myself care about studying my spiders and wasps anymore. I was just like, there's just so much bigger things out there. Like, why am I going to spend all my time doing this when the big questions that we've had answers to for a long time are just being completely destroyed, being eroded? Not just because people are ignorant, but there's like this active movement to destroy these things. And I look at what I'm doing on the sex and gender stuff. This is what Coleman Hughes is doing on the racial stuff.
Yes.
Where, I mean, imagine, I just see Coleman Hughes. He's just like, don't judge people by the color of their skin. Like,
mind-blowing.
Content of your character. And he's got a whole book on this whole thing. And it's completely insane. It's like, because Coleman Hughes is so brilliant.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And that he's got to use this, like, Ferrari brain to just, like, go on the little bumper car route just to, you know, follow me. Here's what we've already known about this stuff. And was watching him on, like, The View and all these things. He's just saying the most basic stuff. And that, you know, I love Coleman, and I'm glad he's doing it because someone has got to do it, and he's extremely articulate. But, yeah, I see I'm doing a similar thing. I'm just, sex is real. You know, don't judge people by, treat people as individuals. Like, this is, it's as easy stuff. I'm sure there's other topics, too, where this is just no-brainer.
Yeah. I have a question. So moving away from this topic a little bit, but a question about science, and this is something that I wonder sometimes myself when I just think about the future and I think of all the things that are happening with technology, especially that are going to happen this century. Do you think that there are, what's the best way to word this? Do you think that there are limits? Well, actually, I guess you do think there are limits because we've been discussing this, but what do you think should be the sort of limits or boundaries of, maybe it's a two-part question. Maybe number one is like what scientists spend their time on researching and investigating. And then maybe the second part is what is done with the technology that results from that science or that research. Because as tech gets more and more powerful, I mean, you can, an obvious example of this is AI, but you could think about robotics, you could think about even social media, right? There's a lot of questions of like, okay, maybe you shouldn't. You can see they want to make it addictive, but like, how addictive? You want to, you want to move this thing forward, but how much? There's a lot of talk now about even like longevity science. Like, I've had conversations with people who are like, "Yeah, we need to make human beings immortal," and I'm like, "I think that's a bad idea, right?" But like, So what do you think are those bounds? Just what are your thoughts on that?
Well, as purely of talking about science, I would just want to remove as many. You know, this sounds weird, but as you mentioned, you know, science is immoral, and I think it's good, or amoral, and I think that's a good thing, but people usually mistake that for like, oh no, we should have our values in science, we need to be doing good things. It's like, well, I agree, but ethics is a whole different question, and, you know, that's where the regulatory stuff comes into, like, what are we allowed to do as scientists? What are we allowed to study? That's something, values that we come to and vote for politicians on to make, you know, policies about what we can and can't research. But in terms of just actual scientists, they just need to discover true things about reality. They just need to produce knowledge. And then as a society, we decide, well, how are we going to use this knowledge? What is this? What can we do with it to further our societal goals, whatever they may be? I think a big part of the problem right now is that we've sort of enmeshed the whole morality, the ethics, and the scientists together, where you get these activist scientists now who are, you know, just really trying to distort facts because it suits their political aims. I think a lot of this is because they're also, you know, scientists at universities, they also teach courses, they're interacting with students, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. But this, you know, if they're researching something, if they make some statement, you know, then a bunch of students show up at their door with protest signs, and, you know, they don't want to get canceled and all this stuff. And so it really sort of puts a social taboo on whatever political ideologies are out there on what scientists are willing to say or even study. I mean, I remained silent about these issues for years when I was in academia, just because I knew it would be political suicide, but like, career suicide. But I mean, my job, as far as I saw it, was saying true things about biology, completely politics free, because politically I was aligned with a lot of these people. I was coming from the left, and so the issue is having I think a lot of these professors having this close interactions with students. And so, I mean, Eric Weinstein had an idea of we need to separate out like university institutions. We have a separate campus for where the research takes place and then have other people who are instructors. Because the best scientists aren't always the best instructors. And maybe we should be sort of splitting that up into two different things just so the research can go and do its own thing without having to consider like, as a mob of students going to come and do a sit-in in my lab or something like that. And I think that should definitely help with things. But ultimately, the science needs, people just need to find out true things about reality and be willing to say true things. And that's really it. Everything else is ethics and, you know, really complex, and we can have disagreements about what those things are, but ultimately it's something that's outside of science.
Yeah, I get that. I think at the same time, I think they're separate fields, but they necessarily just in reality go hand in hand. Because when you talk about science, you're also delving into technological developments. You're delving into everything to do with computers. You're going into pharmaceuticals. You're going into, like, so their ethics, philosophy, morality, these type of things, it's a kind of a different world. But at least when I look at it historically, this hasn't always been the case, but when science has done its most good or the best things that have come out of it, it's saying, okay, we want to discover things that are true and we want to look into reality and investigate the design of everything, but we want to do it in a way that benefits humanity.
Yeah, it should
right?
be.
Like, yeah, like that, that's what it's always been. And something that makes me, I don't know if nervous is the right word, but I have a lot of trepidation about right now, is just given the time we're in and how quickly things are just accelerating, is thinking, well, to what ends? So is the goal of this to make society better and make our countries better and make us healthier and improve us? Or is it to enslave us, essentially? Or even replace us. So if I think of something like artificial intelligence, there's a level of AI which I think is very clearly beneficial to humanity. But you don't need to be a futurist to imagine a version of it or a level where it gets to where it's like, okay, you're no longer helping people, you're displacing people and you're replacing. Like if you got an AI that was so powerful that it's essentially just like replaced people in large swathes of society and job sectors and all of that, to me that's an obvious net negative to humanity.
Yeah, maybe,
so it's like,
especially if it happens all at once too, if people are suddenly out of a job.
Yeah, so it's like scientifically, technologically, it's like, oh cool, like interesting that that's even possible.
Yeah.
But it's like, well, do you want to do that? What for?
Yeah, I would still separate out a little bit. I mean, because engineering is, you know, obviously they all make contact with science and pharma, you know, pharmaceuticals, those are contacting science because the science matters of, like, you know, what does this molecule do to your neurotransmitters? That's something that science can tell you. Mm. But science can't tell you, like, should you give this to a kid that has, that's depressed? Mm. Like, science can't tell you that. They can say, like, well, if you give it to a kid that's depressed, like, here's, you know, long-term data on based on these things we decided to measure. But, you know, those are still in the realms of values. Or like science can tell you, you know, the intricate physics of electronics and how electrons are moved and how we can, you know, deal with like nanotechnology. But they can't tell you whether we should give your iPhone to your child, your young child, because that could have effects on their brain. So, I mean, if we're talking about just science purely in the terms of like, well, what is the nature of matter and physics and how do these things move and how does this interact with each other? That's still one thing. But I agree that we need to have those other conversations about, you know, pharmaceuticals. Should we be giving kids a lot of drugs? I mean, I think it was over 50% of progressive women have some sort of disorder, some mental disorder, have been diagnosed with that. And that's insane. Like half, more than half of the people. It's normal now. It's, you know, the most of them have been diagnosed.
Yeah,
and so we can have, I think those are questions of ethics of pharmaceuticals and how, you know, corporatism, how that goes far enough as well. I think those are things we definitely need to to worry about. It's tough with AI because obviously if you hamstring yourself, then, you know, other countries are going to go hog wild with it. And so you get to a place where it's like, well, it's inevitable. It's going to go to 11 and we just need a
nuclear,
you know,
atom bomb style.
Yeah. So it's just maybe the best way we can ensure that not one person or one country or something takes over is just the mutually assured destruction type strategy. Mm-hmm. And because it's cats out of the bag now on some of these things. And, you know, that's horrifying in its own right. But we need to have major discussions on the ethics of how we should be doing these things, because a lot of them has been taken for granted. And a lot of it people aren't even aware of due to the certain regulations. I used to work at Bayer Crop Science.
Okay.
And Bayer got sued big time before because they killed a lot of bees with their pesticides. And I was involved in testing pesticides. And I won't name any names of people there, but they were testing a new pesticide on bees. And so we had these experiments going where it's like, okay, we're exposing them to this pesticide. And by law, they only had to run the experiment for like 2 weeks or something, maybe even 10 days. And that's the only data you had to report for all this approval. But we kept the bees in there for a little longer, just, hey, let's see what happened. And it was like after 2 weeks, you know, these bees start dying off big time. And it's, you know, it's just people inside being like, well, we only have to send them 2 weeks of the survival data. And it's just like, this is evil. So, yeah, people don't realize what the regulations are. They don't feel like they have a say in it. And a lot of the companies try to keep it under wraps because they're just making money hand over fist. So, yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah, follow the money on these things. There was something that you brought up earlier, which I wanted to come back to because I think it'll be an interesting conversation. So you were saying that for most of your adult life, you didn't want to have kids, and now you have a strong desire to procreate. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I haven't talked about it too much, but it hit me all at once. It was like one of the most significant moments, I guess, of my life, I would say. So a little bit of backstory. My family, we're just so close. I have the best mom, dad, brother. We are a really, really small family. Both my aunts never had kids. So really, it's just me and my brother, my mom and my dad. We have and two aunts right now. And I just had such a fulfilled childhood. It was such a loving environment and just the best parents I could ever imagine having. Whenever I do anything, I call my mom and I call my dad. You know, I got an article published here. I just, you know, graduated college. I got my PhD or whatever. Like, that's where I gained all of the meaning from my life. It's my relationship with my family. And I'm coming to realize now that I didn't appreciate the fact that the current family setup, being someone's child, this is an ephemeral thing. This is not lasting forever. And that came starkly in my attention during, I think it was 2020, maybe 2021, during COVID, where my dad took a major fall. He stood up to go inside, and he's in his mid-70s, and he had to not eat anything because he was going to have a procedure, but he ended up just eating, really having no carbs whatsoever. So he stood up to walk inside, had a sort of blood sugar went down, a head rush, and he ended up fainting. And he hit his head on the tile. Ooh. And it was really, really bad. And I was in the other room at the time. My brother came in, and I, you know, the dad fell. And so I came out and, you know, he was just sort of like twitching on the floor. It was really horrific. And then, you know, slowly kind of came to, didn't know where he was, had a difficulty speaking. He's fine now. So that's, you know, that's great. But one thing that popped in my head when I saw my dad in this extraordinarily frail state of, you know, I didn't know if he was dying right there or whatever. Of course, like, concern was the main thing in my head, but then the strong internal sense of, like, the family is not going to be here. Like, at some point, my dad's going to die, my mom's going to die, and it's just going to be me and my brother. And I just knew, I just felt at the time that I need to create my own, I need to create this family unit again. I need to have this, you know, not play the role of a kid. It's going to be a different role, but it's going to be, you know, something I can extract meaning from and create meaning for somebody else. And I just knew at that moment I needed to have a family. And it was really just instant. I went from being a dink to just like you know, Elon Musk, we need to have, everyone needs to have 10 kids. Like, yeah. I just probably want 2 kids, but I want to start a family. Like, that's the number one thing. I just got a house here in Nashville. I made sure it had like a property on it, and everything I'm doing in my home right now is like, I was looking at the trees. It's like, that's where the tire swing is going to go. Like, everything. So it's, it's really just been kind of a bizarre about face on this issue.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Like, I think this is a, it's a really intriguing topic, and I've had a lot of private conversations with both men and women about this. And, you know, we both know and are connected to so many people, and I'm infinitely fascinated by human beings. I just think people are the most interesting subject in the world. And so my experience, like, I'm not married with kids yet, but I absolutely plan to be and will be in the future. And my family dynamic is really different. So I'm from a massive family. So I am the youngest of 5. So I have, you know, 4 siblings who are all married. I have 5 nieces, 5 nephews. My dad is 1 of 11. My mom is 1 of 7. Lots of them have passed away, but I had, I think, 56 first cousins.
Wow.
I don't know how many. So I'm from a giant family. And something that, when you were telling me that story, something that really sort of resonated with me is that something that's not spoken about a lot, if you're coming from a big family, and maybe this is because fewer people are coming from big families now, but you witness a lot of illness and death. So since I was young, I've been seeing like both sides of the two ends of the human equation, birth and death. I've been seeing constantly, especially since my teens onward. It's like every year we lose family members, and every year new ones are born. And so that sort of circle of life type of thing has been really like apparent to me. I think I'm much more aware of mortality than the average person. So, you know, you got hit by that, right? Your dad fell. Thank God he's okay. But you had that thought of, oh my gosh, like my dad's mid-70s. Like my dad is 78. My mom just turned 70. And you're like, they're not going to be there forever. And you've got uncle passes away. All my grandparents have passed away. They've all been dead for over a decade. One of my grandfathers died before I was even born. The other died when I was a baby. Both my grandmas passed away, I think 2010, 2011. And so you just see that. And for me anyway, it's always made it like, it's made it just like really clear. Like, yeah, you've got to kind of keep this legacy going. And also, the thing that really strikes me is if I just think that someone can think about this through a purely biological lens or a religious or spiritual lens, but or both, but we are all the result of an almost infinite chain going back of reproduction, right? Like the fact that we are even sitting here is because our parents and their parents and their parents and their parents, however back you go, thousands of years, decided to procreate. And so, look, people, of course, in a free society are going to make their own decisions, right? But to think that I'm just going to be like, okay, it ends with me. Bye.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I can't do that, right? Like, you know, I'm aware, you know, some people have fertility problems and so on. There's people who desire children, can't have them. But like, to do that, like, intentionally and consciously on multiple levels, I'm just like, that would be wrong. That would be wrong to just like end that with me and just be like,
all your ancestors, you're sitting in a cave somewhere. Yeah. Like, you're going to end this? Like, I did this for you guys. Yeah. Like, I'm literally out there spearing mammoths. And, yeah. Look at this guy.
Look at this guy in his comfy life. He wants to travel more. He wants to do what? And then another part of it as well, just I'm quite passionate about this subject because I think about it a lot, is I also think that a lot of people, particularly in the modern West, young people tend to think of the first half of their lives, but not the second half. So people tend to think of what their life will be like up until maybe like 40-ish, but they never think of like, what am I going to do between like 40 and 90? And 2 weeks ago, it was my mom's 70th birthday. So we actually had, we got everyone together. So we had 23 people under one roof, nice. Like all 10 grandchildren, all 5 kids, spouses. And then we also had other family come in for a party and so on. And so when I look at my parents now, it's so obvious to me of all the things that they've done, all the successes that they've had. My dad's been a medical doctor for over 50 years, treated thousands of patients. My mom's done a lot of amazing things. But as they get into their elder years, it's so obvious to me that what they're most proud of and what keeps them happy and healthy and active and running around, like, people see my parents and they're like, I can't even believe they're as old as they are. Like, my mom can pass for like late 40s.
Yeah, I've seen friends. Yeah, right? Yeah.
And they're like, how? And it's just like,
What's their secret? Where are they getting it?
My mom says, love of God, great marriage, great family. And like, I can just see how much joy they get. And especially, and because the thing is also, if you choose not to become a parent, you're also choosing never to be a grandparent.
Yeah.
As well. And these are some things, like, only in the last couple years, like, it's really hit me. Like, as I'm looking, as my siblings are having kids and I'm seeing each time a new child is born, it's almost like my parents get to be parents again. So yeah. We've all grown up.
It's part of it for me too. I want my parents to be grandparents. Yeah, they're the best grandparents
exactly.
ever.
And it gives them a new lease of life. Like, I've really seen that. Like, it gives them, literally makes them active again because there's kids running around and they're carrying them and they're playing with them. So it keeps them active and moving. Little kids are just so, they're just so funny and weird and crazy. And you just get to live it again. Like, I'm the youngest, so I never saw it until I became an uncle. I became an uncle at 20. And my eldest niece just went to university. She's 18 now. And so even from an uncle perspective, I've learned so much from seeing these little boys and girls growing up and then becoming teenagers. And it's, all of that is, I feel like it's kind of an advantage in a way, because I've been able to see, see it up front and just be like, okay, cool. Like, I know somewhat what to expect when that time comes.
I think that's interesting about, you know, you've experienced sort of family mortality more so, that maybe has given you, you know, you saw the cycle more. I lost two grandmothers. Never met any of my grandparents. They passed away before I was born. But I just think it's an interesting way to look at it. Something that I didn't experience that much at all, because our family unit were all pretty healthy and I just never really saw the turnover.
Yeah,
and
people get old, man.
Yeah, it's a scary thing to think
about.
People
get old, and some people also don't get old. Yeah. Like, I have a lot of cousins. So my family background's from Nigeria. And in Nigeria, I'm sure you're aware of sickle cell anemia.
Yeah.
It's quite common in that part of the world. So I had many cousins. I had several cousins who were born with sickle cell anemia, who died in their, you know, late 20s or in their 30s. And so I've also seen that end of just like, oh, crap. Like, I hope I live a long, healthy life, and I do my best to do so, but it's not guaranteed. And so with many of the things I do, I have this sort of constant motivation and idea in my mind of like, okay, I don't have forever. Like, I've got the things I want to do. Like,
I need to start having kids soon here. I mean, I just turned 39 recently. I would love to have a kid at 40. Also, I mean, it's going to sound silly, but I saw Elon Musk posting on X about, you know, maybe we're 10 years out before we land on Mars. And I was like, my kid will be 10 by the time. And that is a great age. And like, I want my kid to be able to sit around the TV and watch humans land on Mars. And like, that's the stuff I think about. And I'm just thinking about, it's like, you know, I guess there's maybe some selfish, I want to see my kid do that. But if really, I just want to give them these experiences now. I just want to be. I just want to give myself to my family and my kids. That's all
I love to hear that, man. Yeah. No, it's really positive to hear that. And I also just think that people who would be good parents should be parents.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of sad when you have people who are smart, healthy, good morals, good ethics. They're good people, and they're. I can think of many people I know like this, and like, oh, he's just don't want to have kids. And I think it's kind of a shame. It reminds me of have you seen Idiocracy?
I see it every day now.
It reminds me of the beginning of that movie, and I'm just thinking, gosh, we don't want that to we don't want that to happen. And when you look at certain nations, like South Korea is in big trouble.
Their birth rate is
under 0.8.
Yeah.
Under 0.8, I was talking to a demographer called Stephen Shaw, and he told me that what that means is that for every 100 South Koreans right now, there will be 4 great-grandchildren.
That's crazy.
And that is actual civilizational collapse. That would just be the almost voluntary extinction.
Yeah, yeah. Of I can't imagine. A group of I mean, people. Just the economy itself is just going to go.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. I mean it just
every society has sort of this like embedded growth like obligation to it. So, yeah, it's scary. I mean, we see. I'm worried about the boomers in the U.S. dying. I'm like, what's going to happen to my property value? I want to give this to my kids. I'll make it back to the kids, so I'm not totally selfish on that aspect. But yeah, I mean, it's just going to be a whole new chapter. I mean, I think that's just, and I hear people say too sometimes that, well, you're not truly an adult, you're not truly a man until you have a kid.
Yeah.
And I used to be like, whatever. But now I'm just kind of like, I kind of see that. You know, it's just a whole other.
I get that. I think
a whole other role. You know, it's just the fullness. You know, you've played all the roles in life.
Yes.
And maybe when you get to a grandparent, that's the final role. But
yeah, that's how I think of it. I want to experience the full. I've done a lot of cool things, and a lot of people would look at my life and be like, man, you're living a really cool life, and you've done so much. And it's like there's whole chapters of the book that haven't even been opened yet, and I'm excited about that because I would like to experience the full human experience. And if I were to forego marriage, forego fatherhood, therefore forego ever being a grandparent, and just close all of those things, it by definition would be, doesn't mean I can't have a fulfilled and exciting life or I can't be happy, but I'd be severely limiting the potential there, even the potential for your own growth and development, because again, I'm not a parent yet, so I can't speak as a parent, but it's very clear. I've seen all of my siblings go through this process. I've seen many of my friends go through this process, and it does change them for the better. Again, as long as you're a decent person. Maybe if you want to be a deadbeat dad or whatever, then it won't change you for the better, but it forces you to develop. It forces you to take on more responsibility. It forces you to have something that you care about even more, a life you care about more than your own life. And I can think about this intellectually, but I haven't yet experienced it as a
person. I just want to dive right into it. That's what I want to do.
That's awesome, man. Shifting gears, just one last thing I did want to talk to you about, because we've talked a little bit about some of the political stuff, and I don't want to go too deep in politics, but I remember a few years ago you posted that meme with the stick figures of you of you being on the sort of on the center left, and then the thing moves and you're now on the right, and
immortalized that meme.
So talk me through that a little bit more. I've always been more right-leaning conservative my entire life, but I'm curious as to what you've experienced these last few years there.
I mean, so I've always been on the left. I've voted Democrat, but I would never say I identified with the party, because the way I approached politics had always been to, like, well, I look at the political playing field and, like, where are my values reflected, and that's kind of where I'm going to vote. And that used to be, I guess, center left. And so on the cartoon, that's kind of where I am. And then the person to my left, I assumed was like a fellow liberal, and I use liberal in the classical sense, because that's kind of what I am. I'm kind of like a Bill Maher liberal, I guess, where, you know, limited governments, but personal freedoms, that type of thing. But I'm not, you know, socially conservative. So that's kind of where I felt comfortable. And, you know, they were a little to my left, but it's like, whatever, you know, we're basically this.
Same side.
Same side, at least so I thought. And then it was when the woke stuff took over, which was, to me, one of the most illiberal ideologies there are. It's all about censorship. It's very authoritarian. And so a lot of the values that I had that made me be on the left and be a liberal was, you know, things like, I guess, racial issues, which the left has kind of moved away from in terms of the DEI stuff, the CRT. You know, I still am the judge people by the content of their character stuff, you know, the Coleman Hughes side. And now, you know, a lot of the CRT DEI stuff is like just explicitly prioritizing racial quotas for different things, and it's not merit-based. And so, well, that's something that lost me. I always thought women and their reproductive rights were important. Women's rights just in general. And, well, now the left doesn't know what a woman is, and so you can't give something rights if they don't know what it is. They can't actually classify it and describe it. So they lost me on that one.
Freedom of speech.
freedom of speech is the other major one. When I started seeing people on the left say freedom of speech, and they'd use scare quotes or like so-called freedom of speech, and just how they actually were a super authoritarian, at least when I started saying true things about biology, it didn't align with their politics somehow. And so, you know, they tried to ruin my entire career. Mm. And they probably so I was a postdoc at Penn State at the time, and I was on the job market looking for tenure track jobs, and people would post on the biggest job boards there are that everyone in my field goes to. They would post these job listings, but they weren't job listings. They were just statements about Colin Wright is a white supremacist, transphobe, don't hire him, he's at Penn State, all this stuff. And I can't delete him. This is, I have to contact the board moderator. And, you know, everyone in my field is seeing this. People had told me they'd contacted places that I was applying to or any job that was offering for a behavioral ecologist. They would just send emails to them telling them not to hire me. I talked to people who were in departments, and they said how they liked my work, but they don't even let the actual scientists in the department make hiring decisions anymore. It has to go first through a filter of the DEI HR department, and they're like, there's no way your application is going to get even through. And so I ended up leaving on my own because it's just the whole environment was so toxic, and the activists had tried to make it even more toxic for me and destroy my reputation. And so, yeah, so free speech, the women's rights, racial issues. I mean, those are probably pretty big. I mean, they're big things.
What about stuff like, I mean, safety and security and borders or lack thereof?
Yeah, that too. I mean, that too. Those are also big. Yeah. And I've just kind of more, I now consider myself probably center right, whatever left and right means nowadays. Yeah, I mean that's just kind of where I am right now. That's what my cartoon meant to show. I kind of updated it, having like the left going, you know, meeting the far right again, because you get, you know, Constantine Kissens talks about the woke right now, and
I think I say it's like Pac-Man. You know, the old school Pac-Man.
Yeah, you
arcade.
Go off one side.
Yeah, you go all the way to the far right. You pop out on the far left, and vice versa. I think that's what happens in reality. Because some of these things are just something that struck me when you were saying that was, I was just thinking that that's actual wicked behavior for someone to go to the board or like people, colleges or jobs someone's applying for or something like that, and to be sending these like false accusations and slandering. Like, to me, that's wicked, evil behavior. Because I can't like fathom myself doing that.
Even most if stressful time of my entire life.
Yeah, even if I thought there could be someone out there who I think has just, you know, bad ideas. I don't like them. I don't like their personality. I disagree with them. All these, it would never even cross my mind. And I'm busy. Like, I don't have time. Let me go and find out. Let me do all this research on them. Like, let's get a whole team and try to destroy their life, destroy their ability to earn a living, and for to support their family. To do, like, to me, that's evil. That's wicked behavior. That's like a line that's crossed where you just don't do that to people. Even if you, I mean, in your case, it's even more ridiculous because it's not like you're.
Yeah.
Even if
the most benign thing in the world.
Yeah, you're a mild mannered guy. You're a decent guy. I know you, and it's so odd because I find that to this day, a lot of people like to, especially people who maybe are naturally more liberally inclined and have kind of been more on that side, they often feel that they need to defend it and be like, oh, like, you know, they're actually really nice people. But I'm like, look, if someone is engaging in that behavior, you are not a nice person. If you are going and you're trying to, you know, mass report someone's account to get them suspended or deleted from something or whatever because they said something, you know, like, that's not nice behavior. Mm-hmm. That is not, if you're a genuinely good human being, no matter how much you may disagree with someone or even dislike the things that they post or whatever, you just don't do that. It's too severe. Just like you don't engage in violence, right? When you're getting these people, whether it's Antifa or whatever, and you're going out there on the street, mm-hmm. and you're physically attacking people because you don't like their views, you're not the good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not the good guy. There's a lot of people in this world I disagree with. I disagree with everybody on something. But the idea that I'm going to go out on the street and start physically attacking people because I disagree with them, I don't know, socially, culturally, religiously, politically, whatever. Everyone would be like, yeah, you're the extremist, buddy.
Yeah, well, this is how they keep people with really normal opinions from ever saying them, is because they swarmed really hard when they saw a vulnerability that I was a postdoc and I don't have a tenure-track job yet. Maybe I had like 10,000, 15,000 Twitter followers at the time.
Yeah.
And they went completely nuts. And it was the most anxiety-filled time of my entire life, for sure. Because I was like, I've been studying this for 12 years. I just got my PhD, you know, a year ago. And like, now it's all, everything's ruined. Like, what do I do? But now that I have way more Twitter followers than I had then, they don't bother me anymore because they can't do anything.
I've become uncancelable.
Yeah. I can just say like, whatever. I don't have to like cower and be like, I hope my advisor doesn't find out about this. So it just shows you the insidious nature of what they're doing. It's like they go after the people that they think they can get a scalp from that person and that person. And if they thought they hate me, they tried to come after me by going after DonorBox. I got kicked off of PayPal for life.
Wow.
Etsy, lifetime ban. Again, just for saying there's only two sexes. I mean, the PayPal was ridiculous because I was using that just to get donations.
Yeah.
And there was even nothing associated with it. And just out of the, just nuked it from orbit. PayPal just, nope, violation. And then they tried to go after DonorBox to keep it so I could get, you know, donations that way.
This is evil behavior.
Fortunately, Substack is, I mean, that's where I'm making most of my income is Substack. It gives me the ability to speak freely and to be here and drive myself, put gas in the tank and more. So I just got a home. But I don't know what I would do without some of these things. But being uncancelable, they don't even care anymore. I mean, they care. There's no wedge, there's no inroad to do any of that. I mean, I think they, in the end, they really messed up because it would have been probably in their best interest to just let me get that tenure track job and just study bugs for the rest of my life and have me just do that. That's what I have. We have some students here because now I'm in the courtroom battling their ACLU lawyers, getting the law changed in a bunch of states in Australia and in Alberta, Canada now. So they created a monster.
So. There we go, man. Well, Colin, it's been awesome speaking with you. I admire your courage and your tenacity and constantly trying to seek the truth. I think that all truth seekers and truth speakers, regardless of exactly where people may sit on various spectra, I think they're all coming together in a really interesting way. There's this sort of alliance that is forming globally of, I would just say, truth seekers and truth speakers, and they might be misaligned on some very big ways, but they're crucially aligned on the fact that we want to know what is true and we want to have courage and we want to speak the truth and don't want to deplatform people, want to have those healthy debates and discussions, and ultimately I think want what's best for humanity.
I see you doing that exact thing. I think you're a leader in that space for sure.
I'm trying to
see what you want, and it's, I like what you say, so thank you.
No doubt, man. And where can people find and follow you online?
So you can follow me on X, formerly Twitter, at Swipe Right. That's WRIGHT. And then my Substack, which I publish on. I also publish other people. It's kind of like it's called Reality's Last Stand at realitieslaststand.com. And it's a magazine where I write about biology. I also have other authors write articles for me. Science, politics, opinion, religion, various things, multiple points of view. You know, not everything on there is true, even though it's Reality's Last Stand, but at least it'll give you different viewpoints so you can think for yourself, ultimately.
Awesome. Colin, been great to have you on the show again, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.